Well, good evening, everyone. This is an interesting project that you're dealing with. I'm feeling like there's some feedback or something here. Is that, can we adjust the sound a little bit? Thank you. There's a lot going on in theological education and church-related and Christian higher education, raising these kinds of questions about work and meaning. Many of your schools are participating in the project that Lilly Endowment has been sponsoring on financial literacy and trying to deal with issues of understanding finances, both congregational and individual, and implications on student debt. There's this project that the Kern Family Foundation has initiated and shepherded and cultivated. There's a conversation at the undergraduate level on meaning and work and vocation, not necessarily religious vocation, but can you think about work as other than livelihood? What is the connection? Those are all issues related to human flourishing. And it's interesting that at a time when in the United States we're forever like laser beam saying education only has value if it results, if it has an economic impact, that there are others saying, wait a minute, we've got to think very differently about why we do what we do, why we study what we study, and to what end we are working. So I want to affirm the work you're doing in those, in your various projects. I think that my task tonight is to kind of give you a landscape view of evangelical theological education, and then to identify where there might be images of hope or what the future is going to look like, and is that a scary or hopeful future. And whenever you talk about evangelical theological education, then the first place you start is what is evangelical. So I need to tell you how ATS technically identifies evangelical seminaries. Schools, first of all, if the group that is meeting in Scottsdale, the Fellowship of Evangelical Seminary Presidents, is not an ATS entity. It is a freestanding fellowship of presidents, and their guide is the Lausanne Statement of Faith. So it's a pretty broad evangelical statement of faith. And we think a school is evangelical if their president is a member of the this Fellowship of Evangelical Seminary Presidents, or if the school has a confessional guideline that is fundamentally evangelical in its orientation. That means that for some denominations, one school might be considered evangelical and another school not evangelical because of membership in this in the Fellowship of Evangelical Seminary Presidents. I think that if you were to look at the list, it would look, the vast majority of the schools would fit the broad families of North American evangelicals. They're Wesleyan Holiness, they're Baptistic, they're Pentecostal, they're Presbyterian, they're Free Church, Bible Church related, those kinds of schools. Ones that are classified as evangelical that might look more on the edge. We have now 11 schools in the ATS that are Asian serving. Their primary language of instruction is Korean, Cantonese, or Mandarin. We've classified them as evangelical because that's clearly where their confessional center is, even though they're not kind of cooperative with the trans-denominational community of evangelical schools. We probably have about 110 schools of 270 in the ATS that are classified evangelical Protestant. We have about 100 schools that would be classified mainline Protestant, and the rest are Catholic Orthodox. To talk about the future, two comments as we get started. The first is that I feel like I'm a political pollster on December 1st. Nobody got it right. And because pollsters can only predict from past performance. And when you have a new political phenomenon happening, it doesn't show up in how they weight the data. And the ones that weighted it in more traditional ways were the ones that were further off. The ones that came up, like the Southern California project, that weighted it differently, came much closer to predicting the outcome. The second is that there's an inverse relationship between how much the question of the future of theological education is asked and how readily it can be answered. You only ask that question when it can't be answered. It's not asked a lot of times because things are rolling along, because change is incremental. It's when everybody's looking and imagining we're at one of those non-continuous moments historically, or that what has been is not going to just gradually become something different. But the problem of transformational change is that it is unpredictable. I've commented elsewhere that we have a lot of ATS schools, including many of the Protestant, evangelical Protestant schools, that will list transformation of students as a primary educational goal. And I've simply noted that while they're happy to, for the students to be transformed, the schools are not so interested in transformation. It seems better when it's the students getting transformed than the institutions. How I'm going to come at the question tonight, and you've got a guide for the things I'm going to say. I want to just make a few contextual comments, and then I want to talk about four realities that I think are the most solid predictors of future issues in evangelical theological education. And then I want to talk about some things that are beyond the veil that I can't give you data to say this is why I think it's happening, and it very well may not happen. I'm only accountable till June 30. in my current job, and then we can move other directions. The first is kind of the contextual issues. Evangelical seminaries, like all seminaries, are deeply dependent on the ecclesial communities to whom they relate. The story of 20th century American religion is the rise to dominance of evangelical Protestantism. From 1950 to the end of the year, evangelical Protestantism replaced mainline Protestantism as the normative Protestant center of American life. That is huge. A short period of time. Seminaries are artifacts of religion building. Denominations don't start a seminary with their last dollar. People start a seminary when there is religion, when there's vision and energy in a religious way of understanding the world. About the 110 evangelical seminaries in the ATS, I think 100 of them are post-World War II institutions. How many in the room are you in school that was founded after World War II? Half of the ones here. And there would be some that would have predecessor institutions, like TEDS and some others, but in their current form, most seminaries, most evangelical seminaries are new. They have been established during this grand wave, this grand movement of the last 50 or 60 years in American Protestantism. And we could come up with theological reasons for that, and we could come up with sociological reasons for that. Seminaries sometimes gravitate to the theological. I've been told some people that I feel like part of my job is convincing evangelicals that they haven't been growing as a sign of God's blessing, and convincing mainline Protestants they haven't been declining as a sign of God's blessing, because they have been prophetically faithful and truthful. We want to theologize about growth or decline. Both ways get theologized. But I think that the sociological factors are strong. Where the growth of American Protestant religion has been is in the evangelical community. That has fueled the founding of evangelical theological schools. That has provided students for those schools, provided donors for those schools. About 20 years ago, I was with the Fellowship of Evangelical Seminary Presidents, and the title of my talk was, What If It's 1959 in the Evangelical Protestant World? And I didn't mean that evangelical Protestants are stuck in the middle of last century, but mainline Protestants would never have predicted the next 40 years of their existence in 1959. It was completely off the charts that what was going to happen, that the balance of power would shift so dramatically from mainline Protestantism to evangelical Protestantism. So whenever we think about the future of evangelical Protestantism and its seminaries, we have to wonder, well, could the balance of power shift? Could the religious preferences of church attenders move from praise songs back to hymns, or to something completely beyond either praise song or informal communitarian worship? Will there be a new liturgical hunger, which in fact we are at times beginning to see, and how well will evangelicals adjust to more classic liturgical forms, etc.? All I'm saying is these schools have been founded on a wave, and no wave lasts forever. And so part of the future is, as a community of schools, how they settle once the force and energy of the wave stabilizes. Growth has plateaued among evangelical Protestant church attenders. And so, the largest denominational community in the evangelical community, Southern Baptist, it's still huge, but it has stabilized. It's no longer growing year by year. It's had ever so slight decline. The same for the Church of the Nazarene. The Assemblies of God and Church of God Cleveland have continued to grow significantly, but much of that growth is outside of the United States. It's the growth of majority world Christianity that's connected with those. So there are some of those indicators that it's not up and better every year, up and bigger every year. And that's going to have a contextual influence. The second thing I wanted to comment is that evangelical Protestantism has been the most creative and inventive form of Protestant life across the past 50 years. And the seminaries reflect that inventiveness. I attend the kind of center of the road, the United Methodist congregation. It's one of those congregations that's a larger membership congregation. But my characterization of it is for the sort of like an FM dial congregation. We have a public radio worship service. We have a soft rock worship service. We have a country and western worship service, and so it's sort of like the FM dial approach to congregational structure. That church didn't learn those other didn't invent those forms of worship. The only one it had in sort of its quiver was the more traditional Methodist version of the softened Anglican order of worship. It was evangelicals that invented those other patterns of worship, and mainline adopted them. Evangelicals have adopted multiple new forms of Protestant cost and expression that have never existed before the last 50 years. And so the seminaries. They were the first in the ATS to have distance extension education programs. They were the first in the ATS to move toward distance learning. They were the first in the ATS to really begin expanding beyond the core church professions to deal with counseling, to deal with leadership, to deal with a whole lot of other areas in which they now offer professional master's programs. The evangelical schools have been more entrepreneurial, they have been more inventive, and so the issue is, have they run their course? Have they invented everything they know how to invent? Or is inventiveness in their DNA, and they're going to be creating things we have no idea about right now? My experience in ATS after these 27 years is that theological schools function more like basketball players than ballet dancers. And that is that they have to have a pivot foot planted somewhere. And there are two places to plant pivot foots in theological education. One is a kind of educational orthodoxy. The other is a confessional and theological orthodoxy. And so the schools that are very unplanted on their theological commitments tend to be very stodgy in their educational. The ones that are more firmly planted in theological commitments tend to have their free-floating leg in educational and more entrepreneurial ways of doing things. That's a grand generalization and isn't always true, but there is a tendency that way. Ballet dancers get paid to get both feet off the ground at the same time. No school functions very well in that form. Well, so we have a relatively new community of schools, the vast majority post-World War II. They have followed the wave of a formation in American Protestantism that no one really expected following World War II that completely emerged and took over by the end of the century. They have been like the pattern of Protestantism, they've been entrepreneurs. They've been inventing new things. So we walk into this less than certain moment with the dominant Protestant center of gravity with these schools, and with questions about, will the next 40 years provide as many students, provide as many opportunities for graduates to serve as the last? What do you do when it does, if it stabilizes and maybe declines, not the seminary enrollment, but evangelical Protestantism in which your schools are embedded? It's not going to go away. It's not going to dissipate. We're not going to come to mid-century and say, well, there used to be evangelicals. They are going to continue to be the dominant presence in American Protestantism and probably in Canadian Protestantism as well. But, you know, the things that make you light in the water also mean there's not much ballast there. So the evangelical seminaries have a third of the endowment of the mainline seminaries. And the endowment probably really helped mainline seminaries deal with the shifts in their overall capacity and in the religious communities to which they're related. I want to talk about four things that I think are kind of, they're the ones that are already going on, that are likely going to influence the future. And I'm reminded of what William Faulkner said, the past is never dead, it's not even past. We are always living out of the past, and the future doesn't just come out of nowhere. It comes out of, some of it anyway, it comes out of forces that are already at work. One of those is that we are dealing with the fact that enrollment has begun to decline in both evangelical and mainline Protestant schools. So you have figure one there showing the enrollment, and you'll see what's happened both in the proportion of students. These are students enrolled in schools that ATS classifies as either evangelical Protestant or mainline Protestant. There are evangelical students enrolled in mainline schools. There are mainline students enrolled, but this is just taking the school's identity and then adding up this enrollment. And you'll notice that enrollment kind of peaked in about 2003 or 2004 for evangelicals. And from then, even with the little, we don't have the fall data in and cleaned yet. Most of it's in, but and we will have, by February, we'll have fall 2016 data at ATS. But evangelical enrollment has declined about 6% overall. Mainline enrollment has declined about 20% overall. So we've got about a 10% decline of enrollment in ATS, of total number of headcount students. And the larger proportion of evangelical schools and the smaller decline is kind of holding up the number a little bit. So if it were not for the evangelical schools, the decline would be even more significant. We've looked at our data as many ways as we know to look at it. Mm-hmm. We've tried to find the silver bullet, what predicts decline. About 35% of the schools have increasing enrollment. About 20% are stable within 2 or 3% of where they've been. And about 35-40% have declining enrollment, more than 4 or 5% over consecutive years. And we've tried to predict which pile the schools are going to be. We've looked at it a variety of ways, and we haven't been able to come up with the silver bullet that allows us to say these are the criteria that will predict growth being the criteria that seem to be associated with declining enrollment. What I would say about evangelical schools is they've done so many things to keep their enrollment propped up. First with extension centers, then with distance learning, with expanding their degree program options, lots of counseling programs in evangelical schools, lots of leadership programs in evangelical schools, as well as programs in more church and parachurch oriented kind of areas. So what's the next group of inventions that's either going to keep enrollment, that's going to make enrollment grow? I don't know. You may have ideas what your school is working on. We collect the information at ATS. We don't tell the schools what to do. I think that the enrollment issues are not outside of individual schools' controls, but it's probably something going on more than just variables in which schools have full capacity to change it. Every school that's in financial trouble, when we're dealing with it at the commission on accrediting, the plan is to get more donors and to get more students. And you can only get as many students as there are people who want to come to seminary. And people coming to seminary tends to be out of religious sensitivities and the growth and commitment of religious sensitivities. And those are beyond any one school's capacity to cultivate. So we'll see what happens. The second big driver that's going to be more influential as we move forward is that, particularly in the U.S., but also some in Canada, is the changing racial ethnic character of the American population. You know where we're going. Somewhere in the 2040s, persons of color will be the majority U.S. population. That is a great blessing. And it will be up to evangelical seminaries to figure out what to do with that blessing. They're not going to keep it from happening. And if the Falls campaign part of it, maybe a small part of it, was about trying to reclaim the white America, it just isn't going to happen. It is not going to happen. And it doesn't make any difference who's president or who's in the Congress. What's going to happen because of birth rates, because of a whole lot of other things, is we are 30 years from being majority persons of color in this country. You now have the MDiv students in class that are going to carry their congregations through that shift. It's going to be their career story. And you may not know this, but Americans have not always done so well with race and religion. We just haven't figured out how to make that work, and there are different ways to think about it. What we know are communities of color are more religiously active than white communities. So religion is not going to decline because the growing part of the population is more religiously engaged. Reginald Bibby does sociology of religion in Canada, and a lot of predictors, and he was predicting this great decline of religious participation, and in fact, Canada's had some increase. And what Reg said was, I didn't account for the immigrants. I didn't account for the phenomenon that there are new communities with religious energy that hadn't been part of the old formula. And that's going to be part of this. Well, what are evangelical denominations? What are mainline denominations? What are individual congregations? How are we going to deal with that? I have two pieces of information. You'll notice on figure two that we don't do a lot of publishing of data, evangelical versus mainline, so I'm kind of pulling some things. That's part of why I was hesitant about putting this up on the... Because schools don't claim to be evangelical. We assign them that category. And so we're tentative about, but I think most of them would be comfortable that they were there. Some would like to be there that aren't because they think it might be good for constituent reasons, but they really aren't evangelical. Some are evangelical, but you'll notice that both evangelical and mainline schools have exactly the same percentage of students of color. They both have 39%, if you include visa students, students of color. But the composition of those communities of color is very different between the two schools. You'll see that almost half of all of the students of color in mainline schools are African American. For evangelical schools, the communities of color are much more broadly distributed, with much higher percentages of Latino and Asian, a smaller percentage of persons of color who are African American, and a slightly larger percentage who are visa students. Here's my prediction. That mainline Protestant education, when you get into the questions of race and theology, tends to be a black-white, just because that's the dominant groups that are there. That's a different conversation than the black, than the white Asian, or than the white Hispanic. And so I think that I would say evangelical schools are poised for some pretty interesting moments in the future, because they're kind of equally engaged in all of these communities of color. Doesn't mean they've got it right. That we convened a conference about 15 years ago of persons who were the first person of color on an ATS faculty at their school. And it was sort of a weekend of testimonies. My colleague and I were the only two white guys in the room. And all of these schools can inflict their own portions of pain on faculty of color. And we're learning. But it's not an evangelical or mainline thing. It is how how we learn a number of issues. If you look, however, at the distribution of faculty, now evangelical is behind mainline. So the percentage of mainline faculty of color is greater than the percentage of evangelical faculty. There is a fundamental educational impediment to the effective education of communities of color if the faculty is not of proportionately of color. It's because we do practice our faith differently, and however committed as white people are, we haven't crawled inside of the ethos and the character of the Black Baptist Church or the deep Hispanic Pentecostal Church. You can be sympathetic, you can be engaged, but kind of live with the real kind of street smarts that it takes to be a good guide to those students is harder. And so communities of color provide the connection to the ecclesial communities with whom students of color are most typically associated. So on the one hand, the good news is distribution, inclusion of a lot of students of color. The more questionable news is, do we have the right faculties in evangelical schools to really educate those students in the way they need to be educated? So one of these drivers is the general religiosity in the culture that influences enrollment. Second is the racial ethnic composition of the culture that's going to challenge and change American religious practices, and that's going to have an influence on evangelical schools. And then we have our good friend finances. I spent 15 years at ATS before I finally came to the conclusion that Jesus' comment that you have the poor with you always was not really a statement about theological schools. but they have been perennially poor hearts if you look at the rest of higher education. We just don't have the financial resources. Our salaries don't look like the salaries of higher education in general, et cetera, et cetera. So I wanna pause a minute here on the issue of financial stress that schools are experiencing. Financial stress is no respecter of theological position. And the stress comes on the conservative and the liberal, on the orthodox, and we're not sure what we are, kind of theological schools. We've identified at ATS five primary revenue streams. If you look at with four streams that are combined in different ways. One stream is tuition, one stream is current gifts, one stream is endowment, another stream is religious organizations. You can take the typical budget of an ATS school and use those four factors and come up with the streams of revenue that fund it. And in this chart, we've identified the schools whose majority stream is one of these. So you read this chart, 30% of the schools, a majority of their revenue is tuition. 20% of the schools, a majority of their revenue is current gifts. Then we looked at ecclesial family, and you'll notice that evangelical schools show up primarily twice in this category, and that is with tuition and gifts. So the two biggest streams of revenue in evangelical schools are either student tuition or gifts, current gifts from donors. Most evangelical schools are not related. The part of the invention of evangelical theological education is the non-denominational freestanding seminary. Before World War II, there was hardly a non-denominational freestanding seminary. There was Asbury, there was Westminster, Philadelphia. But most seminaries prior to World War II were deeply embedded in a denominational structure. The evangelicals invented a lot of schools that are not directly related to any one denomination and are not on that denomination's declining capacity to fund. It's no better for the ones that were funded by denominations because of declining denominational capacity. But typically, evangelical, if schools get a majority of revenue from students or from donors. And so just to compare that, we broke that out, but so you can see what it means. Comparing evangelical and mainline schools, mainline schools get less than 30% of their revenue from net tuition. That's all tuition minus scholarships, minus discounting. Evangelical schools get 53% of their tuition, of their revenue from tuition. That's probably why the schools have been as responsive as they've been to distance education, to extension education, to multiplying degree programs, because they live closer to the street of people who pay. Evangelical schools are the only ones in the ATS that will talk about the hours sold, credit hours sold, you know, kind of counting it up. No Roman Catholic school, that doesn't even exist in their vocabulary. To think that way, and it's because these schools are especially sensitive to tuition and especially sensitive to enrollment. If you look at the next and last chart, this is the percent of revenue from gifts and contributions. Again, it's a comparison of evangelical and mainline, and you'll see two things. One, you'll see a general decline in both communities of the amount of the revenue that has come from gifts over these 20 years. This is in percentage. So in 1996, evangelical schools had almost 40% of their revenue from gifts. And in 2015, they had about 30% of their revenue from gifts, and that was up from the prior year. So gift revenue for most schools has not been able to keep up with the amount of revenue, as at least as a percentage of revenue, the revenue that's needed. Now, the other thing, you put these two charts together, we have an increasing amount of revenue from students, from tuition, and what's happening to enrollment. Slight decline. So that means over the last 10 years, the schools have been getting more revenue from fewer students. So that's why we have as much of a, part of why we have as much of a debt issue. Part of why it drives other things that relate to human flourishing. We were on one school's case, I remember, one time because it had a deficit budget for crediting, so it worked hard and it turned around the deficit budget. It was no longer in deficit, but what we realized when we looked more closely at the financials is that the exact amount of the deficit showed up now as the revenue from federally guaranteed loans. So the deficit had just been handed to the students. And you know that it's not always that clean. It just so happened in that one school, so you get a story of what's going on. We really have an issue, and probably are at a point where we have maxed out the capacity of student tuition to provide the revenue the school needs. The students can't pay more tuition. We're looking in one of our projects at theological education, social work education, teacher education, other human service, lower paying of professions, to see what's happening in indebtedness, and because social workers don't have a whole lot more money to pay back student loans than our folks do. The horror stories are there, but they're the untypical stories. Those students borrow a lot of money. They borrow, they can pay it back, and ATS, across ATS schools, has about a 5% default rate on federally guaranteed loans, which is among the lowest of any group, which you would expect of our crowd. If it's not, there's more than a financial problem going on. But it does mean they've borrowed enough that it's influenced lifestyle. They've borrowed enough that it influences what call they feel free to accept. So it is constraining expressions of ministry in order to be able to pay the bill for getting the education that you wanted to respond to your call. So it's a real issue, and it's going to drive part of the future. I'm not an economic determinist, but the economics are going to influence how the schools have capacity to respond. If you look at that last chart, Chris Meitzer, our CFO, invented this chart, and we've continued to take a look at it. It's the number of schools that either have excess of revenue over expense or excess of expense over revenue. And we do that for, and we consider, we adjust the data so that we take not what they say they took, what they actually took from their endowment, but we do it as if it were 5% draw from endowment, which is the sustainable level of draw. So if you looked at all of the balance sheets of these schools, you wouldn't find quite the same data we have because we've adjusted their revenue stream for long-term investments. But you'll see two things in this chart. One is, if I compare this chart to the mainline, that fewer evangelical schools are in deficit. But the reason fewer are in deficit is because they don't have anywhere to go. They don't have an endowment to overspend. The only thing they can do is borrow from somebody generally if they're in deficit. So there's high pressure to keep the budget balanced. But you'll also notice that the balance of the budget flows with the national economy. So we have a dot-com bust in 02, 03, and you see that a spike in the number of schools that are deficit. And then we have major problems in 08 and 09, and it took the schools about 5 or 6 years to recover the level of imbalance that they had before the Great Recession. How do you run a school in the middle of a recession? You know, again, it's a factor outside. So with the economy blossoms and is wonderful for the next 20 years, it's going to generally be good for the schools. If it doesn't do well or has periodic signs, moments of decline, then we have a problem. One more ongoing kind of driver. Majority world Christianity, I'll put it this way, as evangelical Protestantism has become the dominant form of Protestantism in the United States, majority world Christianity is going to become the dominant pattern of Christianity in the world. Christianity is growing so fast in majority world. Those communities are starting seminaries, they're engaging scholarship. I've said elsewhere that, you know, we're almost at the point where schools that are not paying attention to the scholarship of the majority world are in the same place schools were in 1950, not paying attention to European and UK scholarship. That where the center of energy is now in the majority world. So part of the future of evangelical theological education is its position vis-a-vis the majority world Christianity, where the most significant energy in the Christian project is centered. And here, evangelicals are more connected to majority world Christianity, usually through fraternal, kind of denominational entities or partnerships with majority world institutions. we're looking at partnerships at ATS right now as part of our issue on global engagement. And far more evangelical schools have partnership with one or more majority world institutions than mainline schools. So if a lot of the future of Christianity is going to be influenced by majority world Christianity, evangelical schools are positioned pretty well to engage that future. They have a higher percentage of visa students. Most of those are coming from fraternal communities of faith internationally. They will stay or they will go. They will help to solidify. There's a lot to do on that. We don't know in North America how to do these partnerships well. We're learning. I was in a meeting through LaSalle Fellowship of Theological Education in Brazil. Many of your schools, deans or presidents were at that meeting. It was on partnership. All of them there had some kind of partnership with the majority world. And half the meeting was the majority world partner talking about what's good and bad about these partnerships. And the other half was the North American side saying, or the European. And there's a lot of work to do, but the structure is developing there. So if I was to say the future of theological education is going to in part grow out of current realities, I would pick these four. And in two of them, evangelical schools are very well positioned. And in one of them, they are precariously positioned. And in one of them, they're positioned about like mainline schools. So the future is going to depend on cultivating donor communities and constituencies. And if your school, so as faculty members, if your school is getting an ever larger development staff and you're worried that the development staff is going to take it over, if it's a good development staff, it's the ticket for the future. It didn't used to be that way. There were more predictable patterns of funding. Now they are not. It takes a lot of effort to cultivate individual donors, work with them over time, move them toward ever more commitment to the institution. Those are the, you know, I'll give myself a little bit more of a sense of confidence on things that grow out of those four areas. These are more the wild card. These are the Rand Paul might win the election kind of thing. I do think of these three, I'm most convinced of the first one, and that is whatever theological education is going to be, it's going to be more diverse in its educational and institutional expressions than it is now. So we're going to have 20 years from now, if we have some schools saying, is that really theological education? We're going to have a whole lot of schools looking at a whole lot of other schools saying, is that really theological education? The kind of normative center of educational practice is going to become much more diverse. And schools will not be able to afford to do everything, so they're going to have to bet on certain educational practices, and a bet is a bet. You don't know until it's over whether you won or lost. But whatever it's going to be, it's going to be more diverse. And you know how it is at a faculty meeting, that people can have almost as much educational conviction as theological conviction. That this is the way to do this work. This is what we have to hope on and depend on. And those educational convictions are all going to be stressed. And people are going to say, why doesn't God let us go back and do it the way that it used to be done? ATS worked with faculty. We're giving a lot of attention to faculty work in administration, faculty work in assessment, faculty work there's a third area, like a presidential candidate, or I've got to remember it now, IT. And they'll all say, you know, I'm doing all of this, working to figure out how to do distance learning. I'm carrying this administrative responsibility that, and none of this is what I thought I was putting into when I worked on a PhD. And it's becoming more and more of the job description of more and more faculty at AGF schools. I don't see a way of getting the work done as it complexifies without this diversity of educational effort. The second one I've already kind of mentioned. The schools that will be most successful are the ones that will cultivate a faithful constituency of individuals and congregations that will provide the needed funding, students, and places of service. Denominations were a proxy for a broader religious community, and denominational seminaries were able to relate to the denominational entity. Now, even if that was once the case, denominations, all of them, in one form or the other, Protestant denominations, are less robust than they were 30 years ago. So the pattern of relationship of the theological school is going to have to be more congregational, rather than thinking that it can relate to the denomination and the denomination is then going to relate to the congregations on their behalf. So I think that, you know, part of the path to the future and a hopeful path to the future is cementing a much more solid relationship with particular congregations who care about the education of persons who may never serve in that congregation, who see advancing the Christian project partly enabled through theological education. Doesn't mean that you necessarily get in their budget. There's as much stress in their budget as there is in most seminary budget, but it does mean you get access to constituencies, and those constituencies include potential individual donors. I think that the general model, Sears has been replaced by eBay, and there's a theological school church version of that kind of show. And now the one that I'm most interested in, and I'm going to spend the first year and a half of retirement really pursuing this one. I think that we are on the verge of a fundamental shift in theological education. That's not a function of finance, it's not a function of enrollment, it's not a function of these other more predictable trends to the future. I think that we are just about finished with the professional model of education. There have only been two dominant models in education in the U.S. since the colonies. The first model was classical education, where you learned the classics of the Western canon. And the clergy were in the same room with the lawyers, were in the same room with others. There was not the technical interpretation of text or tradition. You learned it the way everybody else learned it. You learned these things because they were part of the Western canon that you learned at Harvard College in 1800. The president of Harvard in 1800 came from the pastorate. It was a classical curriculum. And then in the 19th century, we moved to the beginnings of the professionalization. It was the special school rather than the liberal arts college that became the home for theological education. The biblical disciplines to professionalize as a technical way of study. So the predecessor of American Society of Church History and the Society of Biblical Literature are both founded in the 1880s. And so we have specialized schools that create the home for the development of specialized disciplines. And then by the 20th century, as we see medical education and legal education move in different ways, we move toward the professional education of religious leaders. That never sat completely well with evangelicals. It sat better with probably mainline Protestants. And what I think is we spent 115 years developing this professional model, and I think we're beginning to shift out of it. And where I think it's going is a much more formational model of theological education. Here's how it's already occurring. Theological education never stops doing something before it starts doing something else. It changes by adding on layers and layers, and then after long periods of time, some of the old layers finally drop away. So, but what I think it's about, as the society secularizes more, as catechetical work of the church becomes less dominant than it is now, the task of helping people become full and mature Christian human beings is going to be a seminary task. In the seminary where I taught for 12 years, we kind of assumed it was the church's task to make Christians. It was our task to kind of give them intellectual, robust ways of surrendering some of their Sunday school Christianity and take on more serious and substantive ways of Christianity. What I think is happening culturally, and the social location of the church and the culture, even though it looks like particularly evangelical Protestants expressed a lot of control on the future direction of the culture, I think that was an anomaly in this last election. And that the culture is going to continue to secularize. And so we're going to get students who are as confused about what it means to be a Christian as they are uninformed about what it means to really deal with the hard questions of life. Well, we've always held those as important goals in theological education. But I think we've kind of held the formational goal in the background while we held the professional, the religious content, the capacity to do the work. I think that the next model of theological education is going to reverse those two people. And what's going to happen is more and more how we are cultivating authentic moral and religious and spiritual maturity. You won't get there by simply revising the MDiv curriculum. Because how people learn to be faithful is different than how they learn the Greek alphabet. It doesn't mean you stop teaching Romans. It does mean that you may teach it very differently when you come to issues of what does growth in grace over time mean. How you hold people accountable for knowing something is very different from how you hold them accountable for being something. And those are changes in theological education, in the work of faculty, that don't necessarily change the institutional structure, but change its core function in ways that would be discontinuous with its current function. We are set up to be perfectual schools, for people to know certain things and to know how to do certain things. What if the real authenticity of religious leadership. It won't give up on do you know your stuff and can you do the work, but you will have an increasing degree of hollowness if the person is not perceived to be a deeply authentic, faithful, morally and spiritually mature human being. I see parts of this beginning to happen in the changes in the ATS standards in the middle 1990s. For the first time, language in the MDiv standard included moral and spiritual maturity. And it was arguable at that time, how in the world are we going to do that as a group of schools? How are we going to lose our accrediting if our folks aren't morally or spiritually mature when they graduate? So it's in there the most innocuous way. But it's in there. And the questions are the right questions because our schools are not set up to cultivate that as the premier task, educational. Roman Catholic schools are probably set up that way. We really ought to look at what they're doing, because it's a fundamentally formational model of theological education. I have a lot of energy around this idea. I think it would be good for the church in an increasingly secularized society. I think having the competent religious functionary won't cut it, that if people can't see authentic faithfulness, they won't care as much about that functionality. And that's already true. It's already, you know. If you've got a scumbag as a pastor, you really don't care how good an administrator the person is. The one quarter of that scumbag as a pastor. But I think it's going to become even more dramatically clear as we move through the next several decades. And it's going to shift how we do. And so a project like this one is sort of at the center of that. It is a first fruit. But you know from the programs you're running that it's harder to get some of these issues into the curriculum than it is to make them work around the curriculum. And that's because you're working in schools that were invented or formed themselves to be professional education providers. So what's the hope? Justo Gonzalez wrote a brief little book 2 years ago on the history of theological education from the patristics to the present. 2,000 years and 150 pages flat. The hope is the church has never been out without a means of educating its leaders, of studying its text and tradition. It has never been without that. But we've probably had about 12 different fundamental forms of doing that across the church's history. Well, the current is the hope that we're going to keep the current form of theological education, buttressed, funded, marching to the future. Is the hope that the purposes of God for the education of leaders of people of faith and the engagement of ancient texts and modern interpretations in the context of changing intellectual idiom. We've got lots of hope in that. And I don't think that these schools, theological schools, don't die well. They just don't roll over and die. They keep reinventing themselves. They take on different forms. They're chameleon like. They're hermit crabs. They just keep going, you know, find a place, live in a while, go in another. And they're going to continue. But what I think is going to be that ultimately what we're going to be accountable for is theological educators. Not that we've stopped giving people the tradition and helping them understand how to do the work, but that we have dramatically increased the amount of time that we're focusing on what kind of human beings, as Christians, as persons of faith, as leaders, they are going to be. And that is not a gradual shift that's going to come out of what we're doing. That's going to come out of a much more invasive moment. You know, I may be wrong on this one, and probably I'll be dead before we know the answer. So it's a good one for me to write about. Won't have any accountability whether I'm right or wrong. I see it happening. I see signs of it when ATS has a conference for faculty who completed 1 year of teaching, and they come in kind of knowing what the work is, and they're able to take a weekend without worrying what their next week's lecture is going to be because they've gotten through it once. But they talk about being surprised. You know, they've just come out of PhD programs where they could hardly get any access to their advisor, and now their students are banging on the door and wanting to talk with them, and they're crunching their souls with them, and this surprises them. They thought they were coming to a graduate school. and what they're experiencing on these students who are, you know, good theological education has always been soul crunching. But we have a group of students who have fewer places to go other than their faculty for those moments. They don't have the systems in place. And I think that this is, so I don't want to reiterate it. My 45 minutes is stretched to 53, so. That's where I think we're going. Am I hopeful? Absolutely. Is my hope based on a sure conviction that the current educational form is just going to get better and better and better? No, it's based on assumptions that some things are going to happen as we deal effectively with forces we're not in control. And the most simple thing in which we are in control is what do we most want the students to leave our programs of study with? And will we make the changes to move fundamentally in the directions of those greatest desires? So, that's what I would say. I have 15 more minutes on my parking meter.